Good day, and welcome to the Money, Politics, and State Court Conference Call. Today's conference is being recorded, and at this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Nick Alexiou, Associate Director of Network Communications. Please go ahead, sir.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Nicholas Alexiou, and I am the Associate Director of Network Communications here at the American Constitution Society. So pleased you've joined us for our call this afternoon entitled Money, Politics, and State Courts. We're going to take a look at the rising amounts of campaign contributions in state judicial elections and their impact on the administration of justice. We are thrilled to have three remarkably qualified speakers to lead our discussion. The Honorable James C. Nelson retired from the Montana Supreme Court in 2012 after 19 years in the state's highest court. His opinions not only changed the lives of Montanans for the better, but were also remarkably forward-thinking. In Grison v. State, Justice Nelson's opinion struck down a Montana statute that criminalized same-sex sexual conduct between adults 6 years before the Supreme Court did in Lawrence v. Texas. Justice Nelson has also been at the forefront of the debate regarding campaign finance. In Western Tradition Partnership, he recognized that while the Montana Supreme Court was required to follow the decisions of Citizens United, the court's decision was staggeringly wrong. Since leaving the bench, Justice Nelson has continued to speak out forcefully against Citizens United and the impact of money in state judicial elections, taking to the pages of the Missoulian this past July for a powerful opinion piece. He is a graduate of the University of Idaho and George Washington University Law School. Alicia Bannon is currently counsel with the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Her work focuses on judicial selection as well as promoting fair and impartial courts. Alicia is the co-author of The New Politics of Judicial Elections, 2011-2012, which examines the prominent role of special interest money in state Supreme Court elections. She was previously the John J. Gibbons Fellow in Public Interest and Constitutional Law at Gibbons PC in Newark, as well as an adjunct professor at Seton Hall Law School. Alicia has served as a law clerk to the Honorable Kimball Wood of the Southern District of New York, as well as to the Honorable Sonia Sotomayor, then of the Second Circuit. She is a summa cum laude graduate of Harvard College and earned her JD from Yale Law School. Finally, we have Joanna Shepherd Bailey, who is an associate professor of law, associate professor of law at Emory University School of Law, where she has taught since 2004. She teaches torts, law, and economics, and analytical methods for lawyers and statistics for lawyers. Prior to joining the faculty at Emory, she taught economics at Clemson University. Joanna is the author of Justice at Risk, an empirical analysis of campaign contributions and judicial decisions, a study sponsored by ACS, which proves many long-held beliefs about the manner in which campaign contributions can impact judicial elections. She's a summa cum laude graduate of Baylor University and in her PhD in economics from Emory. So, Justice Nelson, why don't you start us off?
Okay, thanks, Nick. I was asked to maybe get an overview of my highlights and experiences as a justice on the Montana Supreme Court, which is Montana's only appellate court and therefore the highest appellate court in the state. I need to tell you a little bit about Montana first, and then I'll tell you about my experiences with the election system. Montana has, under its constitution, and historically even before the present constitution, elected its justices and most of its judges, it's certainly its general court jurisdiction judges, and its justices of the peace, on a nonpartisan basis for specific terms. The trial court judges have terms for 6 years, and the Montana Supreme Court justices have 8-year terms. We stand for election at the end of a term, whether or not there is anyone challenging the incumbent for the seat. So we have retention elections and elections where there's a contested race. And all of these, as I mentioned, are nonpartisan and historically have been that way. The contribution limits for candidates for judicial office in Montana have, again, historically been relatively low compared to contribution limits in other states. Montana's limits have been less than $500 when I was running my last election for the Supreme Court. The contribution limits were $250 per individual There could be no business contributions, no partisan political party contributions, or corporate contributions. So strictly individual contributions with a limit of $250. I stood for election three times. The first two times were uncontested. The third time, was a contested race, and it turned out to be a relatively nasty race. And since we're talking about money and contributions and so forth, to give you an idea of how my campaign was financed, I raised about $250,000, most of which I spent on media, and I raised that largely through phone calls, fundraisers, and that sort of thing. I believe my opponent did the same. Toward the end of our respective races, there was some PAC money that was spent on the election. The plaintiff's bar organization, their PAC, raised and spent a good deal of money on media supporting my candidacy. And my opponent had some PAC money that was spent largely in negative advertising against my candidacy. We had a primary and then a general election in my contested race. I lost the primary. I didn't spend any money on media, which I think gives you an idea how important that is. I didn't spend any money because I knew there was only going to be two people going into the general election, and I chose to spend my money in the general election, which turned out to be a good decision because although I lost the primary, I won the general election. So to give you some idea of what has happened, at least in Montana, with respect to regulation, Montana candidates have always been governed by the Montana Corrupt Practices Act, which set, again, contribution limits on races, who could give money, and then there's a fairly substantial body of regulatory law that implements that, requires reporting and so forth. Of course, under the American Traditions Partnership case that Nicholas mentioned, there was several corporate organizations that challenged Montana's law, Corporate Practices Act, based on Citizens United, and our Supreme Court upheld the law, I guess, on the proposition that there was a compelling state interest in Montana for regulating political speech. I was pretty much the lone dissent. There was one other justice that dissented, although somewhat on a different basis than I did. I wrote the main dissent and argued that, like it or not, Citizens United applied to Montana as well as the federal government, and that when you applied all of the logic and rationale and arguments that the majority set forth, those had each been soundly rejected by the Supreme Court in Citizens United decision. Of course, being a dissent, it didn't carry the day. The case went up on appeal, and not surprisingly, was summarily overruled by the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, among other things, held that Citizens United not only applied to federal elections, but to state elections as well, which could have come as no surprise to anybody since it was really a free speech case. And, of course, the U.S. Supreme Court determines or interprets the First Amendment, and they did. After Citizens United, there was some other litigation which was litigated in the local federal district courts with the result that the Ninth Circuit held unconstitutional Montana's statutory ban on partisan endorsements and expenditures. So although we technically have nonpartisan races for justices and judges in Montana, under the Ninth Circuit, again, based on Citizens United, those partisan organizations can endorse and spend money on behalf of or against the candidate. The Ninth Circuit did uphold Montana's ban on direct partisan contributions to candidates. Again, I think based on Citizens United, but at least now candidates can be endorsed by political parties, which I think effectively ruins the whole point of nonpartisan elections. The last election cycle, which was in 2012, two candidates went into the general election for my seat on the court, which was vacated in early January of this year. I frankly didn't see a whole lot of institutional or corporate money in those races, and since the races kind of overlapped the litigation involving American Traditions Partnership, the two candidates were very careful in disavowing any corporate contributions and business contributions. I think they really tried to comply with the Corrupt Practices Act, which was, of course, basically declared unconstitutional. However, I think it's a whole different ballgame now because of Citizens United and American Traditions, Corrupt Practices Act being declared unconstitutional. I think increasingly we are going to see in Montana, as has happened in other states, and of course the Justice at Risk study discusses this, we're going to see more corporate special interest money being spent for and against candidates in these races. And as we get on in our discussion, I have some thoughts on that, and we'll be happy to share those. But I think this kind of gives you an overview of Montana's judicial election system and my experience with it. And as we go on, again, if anyone has questions or comments, I'd be more happy to address those.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Justice Nelson. So, Alicia, why don't you talk a little bit about the 2012 cycle and what you found in your study that you released at the Brennan Center?
This study, The New Politics of Judicial Election, is a study we put out along, the Brennan Center put out along with Justice at Stake and the National Institute on Money in State Politics, examining the 2011 to 2012 Supreme Court elections, and basically finding that special interest groups around the country have been pouring money into these races, trying to influence who sits on these Supreme Courts as well as the decisions that they make. This is a trend that really started around the year 2000. Historically, Supreme Court elections had typically been pretty low-cost affairs and not overly politicized. That started to change a little bit in the 1990s, and in 2000, it really exploded. You had basically a dynamic where the tort wars suddenly became the court wars. So, you know, business interest groups on one side, plaintiffs' trial lawyers on the other side, started spending increasingly money on Supreme Court races, basically trying to shift these courts, on the business side to make them more amenable to, you know, business interests, on the plaintiff's lawyer side, trying to make them more amenable to plaintiffs' interests. And what it led to was an arms race spending over the course of the past decade. So much of what we found in our report was that 2011 to 2012 was more of the same of what we've seen over the past decade. We saw about $56.4 million spent nationwide, which is pretty consistent with what we had seen the past few years. We saw a real concentration of spending among a few interest groups. So the top 10 spenders nation, the top 10 spenders were responsible for about 35% of all spending nationwide. And troublingly, more than half of all of the contributions to Supreme Court candidates came from lawyers, lobbyists, and business interests. So some of the same people and organizations that will be appearing before these courts to which they're contributing. And finally, we saw that spending was highest on divided courts, so courts that were closely divided between liberal and conservative interests typically had the most expensive races. We saw Michigan, Wisconsin, Florida, and North Carolina, which all fit that bill, were the four most expensive races in the 2011 to 2012 cycle. In addition to some things that were more of the same, we also saw some new trends come out in 2011 and 2012. One of the most striking was the explosion of independent expenditures. About 43% of all spending in this most recent election cycle was independent expenditures by interest groups and parties. And that was a record level compared to just 22% in the last presidential election cycle and 30% in 2009-2010. So what this means is that historically, interest groups and parties spent most of their money directly contributing to candidates, and that's shifting with them now just directly spending on television advertisements and other forms of electioneering. And why we think this is troubling is, you know, one, because many states have weak disclosure laws, it can often be particularly hard to understand where this money is coming from when interest groups start spending independently on things like television advertisements. And two, one of the things that we track in our report is looking at television advertisements and coding their content. And what we found is that, particularly among interest groups, television advertisements are much more likely to go negative. And so if we're concerned about a kind of increased politicization of Supreme Court elections, kind of creating a carnival atmosphere where judges appear no different than other kinds of politicians, this trend towards independent expenditures, we think, is likely to further push these elections in that direction, because those groups have less of an incentive to try to stay positive and to focus on records and experience. And in terms of why this is happening, I think at least part of it is a Citizens United effect. While Citizens United didn't have as much of a direct impact on many states because they already had weak campaign finance regulations around corporate interests to begin with, what it did was incentivize the creation of a spending infrastructure that has now bled into state races in general, and state court races in particular. So, for example, we've seen a rise of judicial super PACs, so-called social welfare organizations that have become much more prominent post-Citizens United, have now turned their sights to state Supreme Court elections as well. To give just one example, we documented that Americans for Prosperity, a Koch brothers-linked group that's gotten a lot of attention in recent years, spent money both in Florida and North Carolina in their Supreme Court races. And the final trend that we noticed was record television spending, which we think reflects the fact that, you know, television is just becoming increasingly important around the country. Increasingly, that's how these races are won. And because with increased spending nationally on all different kinds of elections, it's pushing up the price of television advertisements. That's also, we think, contributing to this upward trend in television spending. In addition to record levels of TV spending, we also documented 10 states, at least, which had negative advertisements, so attack ads or contrast ads, in Supreme Court elections. Many of these ads were frankly doozies. We had candidates accused of helping free a terrorist, sympathizing with rapists, freeing sex offenders, all of which were misrepresentations of those candidates' records. And what is perhaps most troublingly, many of them focusing on decisions that judges had made on the bench. We think that's particularly troubling because it essentially sends judges a message that if you are ruling in a controversial decision, a politically sensitive decision, you're on notice that you may be subject to an attack the next time you're standing up for election. And that's something that we've noticed is particularly common in the context of criminal justice decisions. So, you know, judges are very frequently attacked for being soft on crime, quite strikingly often by groups that are themselves not really concerned with criminal justice issues. So you'll have a group that's focused on tort reform, but the advertisement that they spend money on is attacking a judge on their criminal justice record, and oftentimes distorting those judges' records. So again, we think it's a very troubling trend, and you know, troubling not only for creating increasingly politicized races, but also raising due process concerns. You know, putting pressure on judges as they're sitting on the bench and making decisions in politically charged cases. And in terms of how the, and finally I'll just say that, you know, the public is noticing. Around the release of our report in October, we did some polling around public attitudes towards elections and found judicial elections. And we found 87% of voters thought that campaign contributions or independent expenditures in judicial elections had some influence on judicial decision making. We found 92% of respondents thought that judges should step down from cases where they've received campaign contributions from one of the parties or where one of the parties spent significant amounts of money independently seeking to elect them. While the public feels very strongly about this, in fact, most states don't have those sorts of recusal rules on the books. And so I'll end by just saying very quickly a few points about reform, and I'd be happy to talk about that or anything else when we move on to questions. But, you know, in our report, we talk about a few measures that we think states should consider in trying to push back against this increased arms race spending and the politicized races that we've been seeing. One measure is public financing, which we think is a very important effort that states should be considering. Essentially, what it does is give judges or candidates the option of being able to, you know, rely on public money rather than needing to do this fundraising and rely on special interests. So it allows them to run competitive races without needing to turn to special interest dollars. We also think recusal reform is a very important measure that should be undertaken. As I mentioned, the public strongly believes that recusal reform should be adopted. And, you know, since one of the integrity of our judiciary in part depends on public confidence in our courts, we think that that's a very telling fact that the public so strongly believes that campaign contributions are having an impact and that judges shouldn't be hearing cases where litigants are receiving contributions or where independent expenditures are being undertaken on their behalf. And finally, we think disclosure reform is another important step that should be taken. It's important that the public know where this money is coming from and who's trying to influence the composition of our courts and the decisions that judges are making. So with that, I'll stop and, again, look forward to discussing this further when we turn to questions.
Well, thank you so much, Alicia. And so, Joanna, you know, Alicia sort of touched on it a little bit at the end, that there's this public perception that all this money in judicial elections is having an impact. And so what have you found as to what the actual impact is on the administration of justice?
Yeah, that's a great setup, both of you and Alicia. I'm thrilled that there's all this new kind of more recent data on a lot of the spending. Our study, Justice at Risk, focuses on the relationship between interest group money, and specifically we focus on money from business groups, and the votes that judges cast in various types of cases that involve business issues. So as you've just heard, judicial elections have become increasingly politicized and expensive in recent years. And as you're also well aware, academics, lawyers, policymakers, and judges have grown very concerned about the critical role of money in judicial elections, and that this money gives wealthy interest groups the opportunity to influence judges. So Alicia just spoke a little bit about some of the surveys with voters in which voters respond that they're very concerned about the amount of money. They're concerned about the money in elections and how the money is influencing perhaps the judges. There's also surveys of judges where they ask judges very similar questions. And in some of these surveys, 80% of judges believe that with campaign contributions, interest groups are trying to use the courts to shape policy. And almost 50% of judges respond that money, they believe, has had some influence on their own judicial decision-making. In addition, interest groups are confident that well-spent money will have significant influence on both which judges get elected and how those judges vote once they're on the bench. So there's nice quotes from various interest groups. For example, an Ohio AFL-CIO official said, We figured out a long time ago that it's easier to elect 7 judges than it is to elect 132 legislators. So you can tell kind of what their goal is here. It's much like, you know, the reason that they're spending money on judicial elections is not that different from the reason they spend money on legislative elections. And it's a lot cheaper to elect 7 judges, or actually you only need half of those judges, I guess. There's a growing body of empirical studies over the past decade or so that have confirmed that voters, judges, everyone else, lawyers, academics, policymakers, has reason to be worried that the money is indeed having an influence. Many, many studies find that judges tend to favor campaign contributors in their decisions. And although these studies present convincing results, until this most recent study that I'm about to talk about, the previous studies have all used data from only one state, or they used data from the 1995 to 1998 period, but that was a national data set. And as Alicia's just discussed, circumstances have changed dramatically since that data from the late 90s was collected. The amount of money spent on elections has nearly tripled. It was about $80 million in the 1990s, and it's risen to almost $210 million between 2000 and 2009. And as Alicia also just discussed, in several of the most recent Supreme Court election cycles, the amount of money has topped $45 million in campaign contributions, and that's just direct contributions to the campaigns themselves. In addition to the growth of money, there's been several important court cases that have likely changed the landscape, for example, Citizens United being one. And thus, new analysis using current data are really critical to establish what's currently going on and what the current relationship between money and judicial decisions is. So in response to this need, the American Constitution Society sponsored an objective effort to compile current data. Over the past couple of years, there's been a team of independent researchers that have coded data on more than 2,300 business-related state Supreme Court cases from all 50 states over the years 2010 to 2012. So in contrast to the previous data that people were using from 95 to 98, this is the newest data that's currently able to be coded. We then augmented this case data by adding over 175,000 campaign contributions and many other case and state-specific variables. So before I turn to the results, I'd like to take a moment to explain first why we focus on business cases and contributions from pro-business groups. As Alicia just mentioned, a lot of different interest groups spend money. Lawyers and business groups spend about, if you look at the past decade, about equal amounts on direct campaign contributions to lawyers, but business groups alone have dominated interest group spending during this time. So essentially, we focus on businesses because they spend far more money on judicial elections than any other interest group. They spend more than 10 times the amount of unions, significantly more than lawyers. So although influence from any interest group on judges voting would certainly be concerning, we chose to look where there was the most money and, as a result, the most likely influence. However, some of the earlier studies that were using the data from the 1990s did confirm that money from other interest groups also has a relationship and an influence on judicial voting. I'd also like to point out that we recognize that there's two ways that interest group money can affect case outcomes. The money could determine which judges get elected. For example, by contributing money to judicial elections, those judges become more likely to win. And about 80% of elections, the candidate with the most money wins the elections. So money could just be having this upfront effect. However, that ends up affecting case outcomes because when certain kinds of judges get elected, they're more likely to vote in certain ways. The money could also, the second pathway, influence the judges on the bench to vote in a specific way in hopes of getting future campaign contributions. So although some of the early empirical studies, including some that I've done myself, were able to show that both of these pathways play a role in the relationship between money and voting, in this current study, we're a little bit less concerned about the specific pathway. Regardless of the pathway, interest group money is affecting judicial outcomes. And if we think it's the law that should determine case outcomes and not money, then this is concerning. So now let me kind of briefly, in layman's terms, describe a little bit about the empirical study. We employed a form of analysis called a multivariate logistic regression that's able to isolate the influence on judicial voting of a lot of different variables. So specifically, we include variables that control for the judges' campaign contributions, obviously from interest groups. We also control for the judges' other campaign contributions. As you might expect, $200,000 from a business group has a very different meaning if the judge only receives $300,000 in total versus if the judge receives $2 million in total. So we controlled for where the rest of their money was coming from. We also included a variable measuring the judge's party affiliation. That way we were able to separate the effect of being a Republican or Democrat versus the effect of the money. We also included various measures of the conservatism of the state's laws, citizens, and other government officials. So this way we can make sure it's not just the judge voting in a way that they think is expected by the other branches of government, by the citizens, whomever. And finally, we included a measure of each case's strength in support of the business. So we do this because some cases are just so strong in favor of the business, it doesn't really matter how much money a judge receives. They're more likely to vote in favor of the business in very strong cases. So by including this measure, we're able to see what happens in different kinds of cases. So now to the results. We found a statistically significant relationship between business group contributions and judicial voting. The more campaign contributions the judges receive from businesses, the more likely they are to vote for business litigants that appear before them in court. For example, we found that a judge who receives half of his contributions from business groups would be expected to favor the business interests almost two-thirds of the time in cases that appear before him. However, we found this relationship between business contributions and judges voting only in partisan and nonpartisan systems. We found no relationship between money and voting in other kinds of systems like retention election systems. The data also revealed that the relationship between business contributions and judges voting is stronger among Democratic judges than Republican judges. So at first, this was a little bit surprising. However, what we suspect is going on is that because Republican judges tend to be more ideologically predisposed to favor the business interest in the first place, they're starting at a higher baseline. So essentially, additional business money isn't having as much of an additional influence because they're already starting on a much higher level. And then finally, because the landscape of judicial elections has changed so much in the past decade with more money and new cases, we also compared the relationship between business contributions and judges voting in the 2010-2012 period to the 1995-1988 period using the older data. So although we found a statistically significant relationship between business money and voting in both periods, the relationship had indeed grown much stronger and larger in the more recent 2010 to 2012 period. So to sum up, all signs point towards judicial elections continuing to become more political and more expensive. Our results show that reforms are necessary to protect justice from the destructive role in money in judicial elections. And I will stop there.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Joanna. If anyone has any questions, they can hit *1 on their keypad, and that will unmute your line and get you into our question and answer queue. And I just want to let everyone know as they're doing that, that you can read Justice at Risk, the wonderful report that Joanna was talking about, at the ACS website at www.acslaw.org. While we wait for some questions to sort of stream in, Justice Nelson, I want to sort of get your opinion on what Joanna was talking about there at the end. As someone who served on the state Supreme Court, you know, what is your initial reaction when you hear that judges are more likely to rule in favor of the interest that give them their campaign contributions?
Well, I guess I'm not surprised at that. If the Koch brothers want to put somebody on a state Supreme Court, they probably have the financial ability to do so, and you could bet they're not going to put anybody on the court that's going to be voting in opposition to their interest. I think we saw something like that in the Caperton case. Where the money that is expended on behalf of a judicial candidate is relatively small, I don't think it's probably going to affect the judge's decision, but certainly, and I said this in my dissent in Citizens United, money speech and money corrupts, enough of it will corrupt absolutely, and I believe that to be true.
And I'm curious, Justice Nelson, if you had stayed on the bench with this rising tide, I mean, you'd mentioned that you garnered all your contributions from individuals. If you had stayed on the bench going forward, how would you approach fundraising in the future? Would you have started going to look to business interests to raise money, or would you try to have stuck with individualized or individual donors?
Well, you know, it's kind of a difficult thing. At least in Montana, these interests cannot contribute directly to candidates. They can spend money on behalf of a candidate or against the other candidate, but they still can't contribute directly to campaigns. So I guess your campaign strategy would be to somehow implicitly try to encourage, you know, this expenditures on behalf of or against. And, of course, you have to be very careful about doing that because, you know, the PACs are not supposed to be in communication with candidates. So it presents a very difficult situation. The campaign contribution limits in Montana are still low. So for the candidate to go out and raise $200,000, $300,000, that's, one thing. But if somebody wants to, as I say, spend $1 million for or against, that's a game changer, frankly, in a state like Montana.
Thank you so much. And again, it's star one if you want to ask some questions. And we don't have any questioners right now, so I'll jump in again with another question. You know, Alicia, you talked about how sort of the kickoff to this spending spree happened in the early 2000s, and you mentioned sort of the tort reform battles making their way into the campaign finance war, so to speak. But I wanted to go a little bit more in depth as to what sort of got this ball rolling.
Well, I mean, we first saw some inklings of this trend actually in the 90s in someone you may have heard of, Karl Rove, turned his sights to Texas in the 90s and in trying to shape the composition of their Supreme Court. And I think that was sort of the opening shot in terms of, you know, basically people who had previously really focused on legislative battles, you know, trying to shape policy through the legislature, increasingly recognizing that courts were another avenue and oftentimes a more efficient avenue to get some of the same outcomes. I mean, state courts are incredibly important. More than 90% of all court cases are decided in state court. And, you know, they make decisions about, you know, everything from, you know, employment discrimination, tort law, you know, the contract law, I mean, all decisions that impact criminal law, I mean, impact, you know, many different areas of life. And I think there's sort of a burgeoning recognition that, you know, it was relatively cost effective to focus attention towards shaping the composition of those courts as a way of shaping policy without needing to necessarily battle things out in the legislature. And so, as I said, we sort of started to see that in a little bit in the 90s, and then in the past decade, increasingly, it became increasingly something that more and more interest groups started turning their attention towards. So, you know, I think essentially once the spending started, you began to see an arms race where everybody needed to put more money into these races in order to keep up and to try to shift the composition of the courts.
Alicia, wasn't this kind of a fallout from the, you know, the Reagan revolution of pitting the free market business philosophy against big government and courts and things like that?
I mean, that's interesting. I mean, so the idea being that it was part of a broader kind of conservative revolution that we saw in this country?
Yeah, I think that was kind of my feeling, and things I've read have kind of supported that. I noticed a whole difference in Montana's elections, both judicial and non-judicial, during the, when Newt Gingrich had his contract with or on America, however you want to.
And I'm curious, let me jump in here for a second. And Joanna, you know, Justice Nelson was talking about, you know, the Koch brothers funding candidates, and that's why they get the results. And Justice at Risk talks a lot about the correlation, but I'm curious about the causation here. I mean, are we seeing that it is sort of outside groups getting judges elected and thus sort of doing their bidding, or is it incumbent judges or even independent-minded judges who know that they have to raise money for their election and future elections and are thus sort of ruling in a way that they think will be beneficial to them financially down the line?
Yeah, well, as I said, in this specific study, I've done about 10 studies by now on judges, 10 different empirical studies. In this study, we were a little bit less concerned about exactly which of those two pathways was really driving these results. However, in some of the previous studies, I've tried to tease that out more specifically. So, for example, one thing you can do, for most states, there's a mandatory retirement age for judges. So you can see how in that last period when they have to retire and they can't run for re-election, if their voting changes, because if it does, that would suggest that it was partly the money, the hopes of getting future money that was affecting their current voting, right? And so then when they no longer need the future money, they stop voting in that way. And we did definitely find that the results became weaker, which suggests that at least this kind of forward-looking, hoping to get money is a big part of the explanation. However, the results don't completely go away. So I really think that both of these pathways are important, and, again, a lot of the other kind of empirical studies in this area have suggested that they're both important.
And so would one of your recommendations maybe to sort of stem this tide be something like a mandatory retirement age for state Supreme Court judges? Is that something that you think the data sort of suggests is a good idea?
I think that's kind of an irrelevant, that's not really relevant to the money questions. We just use that as a way to try and figure out how the money was having an effect. So I'm not sure if having mandatory retirement would necessarily do that. I mean, what a lot of other countries doing, I have done. I've also done a lot of research on comparative judicial selection and retention methods. And a lot of other countries just have fixed terms for judges. And so that once, regardless of how they're chosen, sometimes it's appointment, sometimes it's elected, they max out at a certain number of years. In some countries it's 10 years, sometimes it's longer. But they don't have to stand for re-election during that period. And when that happens, they're much more independent, right? We don't have the system like the federal system for judges or judges for life, and some people claim they can get lazy or kind of pursue their own agenda or whatever. We don't have that problem because it's only a 10-year period. But when they don't have to stand for re-election, then they're not so concerned with getting more money in the future. So that's a really far-fetched, obviously, change. I mean, that's a completely dramatic change from what we're currently doing. So I think that a lot of the proposals that Alicia mentioned are probably much more realistic. But nevertheless, that is the way a lot of other countries deal with these problems.
There's a proposal actually in Wisconsin right now to introduce a system along those lines. So it would be a 16-year single term for judges, where they would be elected by a competitive election, but then not stand for re-election. It would just be a single term. And I know it's been controversial because some people worried that it's just going to lead to a huge amount of spending in that one election where judges are standing for election. But it does remove some of the concerns that we were talking about pressure once you're on the bench, worrying about what's going to happen when you stand for re-election. So,
right.
I think there's pluses and minuses to that system, but it's something that I think people in the fair courts community are certainly paying attention to, because it does address at least some of the concerns that are raised about the system as it is right now.
Yeah.
And I think that makes sense to have some sort of a term limit. I hate to use that word, but some sort of a term limit so that you don't have justices on the court that have really outlived their intellectual usefulness. But I have to tell you, I think that because of Citizens United and the money involved, I think that case has pretty much obviated the idea that you can have fair and impartial elections. You talk about public financing. Of course, that doesn't prevent the wealthy candidate from spending his own money on his own behalf. And I'm not sure exactly how public financing enables one to silence these special interests and their expenditures, independent expenditures and so forth. I think recusal is also an important question, but I'll tell you, if I were the Koch brothers and I wanted to make sure that I neutered some justice on the bench, I would dump $100,000 into his campaign and never think twice about it. And certainly, you know, certain special interests can eliminate the judge from sitting on any of their cases by doing that. I don't want to go on here, but I really think the only way this is going to ultimately be resolved is to have a purely merit appointment system. And when I say purely merit, I'm talking about keeping money and politics out of it completely. Most people say we can't do that. I think you can do it 98%, and I've thought of some ways of doing that. But I think that's really going to be the only fix to this. The American public either wants politicians for judges, or they want fair-minded, impartial, intellectual scholars for judges. Experience, and I think the two are mutually exclusive.
Thank you so much, Justin Nelson. We actually have a question.
And this question,
ways that you've thought of to try to have these fair and impartial appointments.
Well,
it would be terrific.
I don't want to monopolize time here, but just very briefly, and I say this very briefly, I think you could set up a committee composed of different categories of people who, by reason of their who they are and the organizations they belong to, would tend to keep the committee as fairly non-political. For instance, you could have the president of the state bar. One year it might be a Republican, the next year it might be a Democrat. But that person would serve on the committee. President of the League of Women Voters, the president of the Taxpayers Association. People like that by reason of their membership would filter in and out of the committee. But I think you keep the legislature out of it. I think you keep the governor's office out of it. And you keep, you make it as non-political as possible by reason of these appointment categories. And that's just my, it's a very generalized description of what I've thought of doing, or not doing, but what I would suggest.
Thanks so much. And again, it's star one if anyone else has any questions. And Alicia, I just want to ask, Justice Nelson has brought up this idea of merit elections, and you had public financing, you had recusal reform, and you'd had disclosure reform. Would you also add public merit elections into this list of ways to reform the system? And would merit elections be sort of the best way to reform the system?
Well, not merit elections, merit appointments.
Sorry.
Well, I think Justice Nelson raises some really interesting ideas. I think, I think there is an important distinction between merit selection with retention elections, which is typically how those systems are done today, and the proposal that Justice Nelson is making, which would take elections out of the picture altogether. I think his proposal is very interesting, and I think, it certainly is something that should be explored. I mean, one of the challenges is that on the whole, states have been pretty resistant, and the public in states have been pretty resistant to doing away with elections. Most states with elections tend to like them. And so I think typically we've focused more on how to structure systems to make those elections as fair as possible, to try to minimize the influence of special interests in those elections. But introducing a kind of nominating commission that would be, composed of individuals who are not highly politicized, and that could perhaps remove some of the specter of politics from these elections, I think is an intriguing idea. And I think another advantage of that kind of system is that you might be able to have that commission also be actively involved in recruiting potential judges to increase the pool. I think one of the challenges with elections is that there's whole categories of people who may not ever be willing to put their hat into that kind of race, but might be willing to be considered by this kind of commission. And, you could thereby increase the diversity on the bench in a whole manner of a wide array of ways. I also, if I may, would just wanted to say a quick response to Justice Nelson's point about recusal reform and public financing. With respect to public financing, I think he's exactly right that you're not going to be able to do away with, you know, the candidate, the millionaire candidate that's going to spend money on his or her own or independent expenditures, you know, that we would, there's no control over that. I do think there are still advantages to public financing, and in, if it's designed well and if there's adequate resources put into that system, it does give candidates enough money that they can at least run competitive races so that they can choose not to fundraise from special interests. If they don't want to, it gives them another option. With respect to recusal reform, I think the point that he raised about, you know, perhaps gamesmanship by litigants is also a really important one. The Brennan Center has actually done some work on recusal issues and put forward model rules for what kinds of what a recusal rule might look like. And one thing that we propose is giving litigants an option to waive a judge's disqualification. So in other words, if you had a case where one side was actually contributing money for the very purpose of sort of forcing a recusal, the other litigant in the case could say, you know what, we waive our right in that case, and we would like that judge to hear the case. So I do think that there are creative ways to address some of the concerns that he's raised, although, as I said, I think they're very important concerns.
Great. We've got a question.
Moving forward, for people in the queue, if you're a member of the press, please provide your affiliation before posing your question. At this time, we'll take a question from Thomas Sussman. Please go ahead.
Yeah, until you get these fundamental changes made in terms of the way of appointing or electing judges, is there something that either by rule or perhaps by less intrusive legislation can be done so that judges who receive contributions and don't believe they need to recuse, either rationally or irrationally, that there's some way of minimizing the effect of the contribution through some sorts of disclosures or disclaimers or statements or just what can we do while we're waiting for global reform?
Closure reform is certainly one other area that's worth putting attention towards. You know, so you can, I think it's important for the public to know where that money is coming from, and you know, to also be in a position to, you know, move for recusal in the event that a judge has received contributions from litigants. I mean, I guess just speaking more broadly about other efforts that could be undertaken to try to address some of these concerns, and one other thing that hasn't been mentioned is voter education efforts. You know, one of the big challenges with judicial races is that they're incredibly low information races, and that makes, you know, negative advertisements, for example, all the more harmful because oftentimes that's all the information that people have about candidates. So putting money and resources towards undertaking nonpartisan evaluations of judges, disseminating that information so that voters have an opportunity to educate themselves is, I think, another important step to take that can, to some extent, mitigate the impact of the burgeoning spending that we've seen.
And I agree. I think, at least at this point in time, disclosure is the most important thing that can be done to at least inform the public where the judge can finance, who's making contribution to his or her campaign. I'm a huge believer in transparency. I think that states have to have strong, effective campaign practices, people to ride herd on the reporting requirements with some prosecutorial authority. I think judges should be required to annually disclose financially what sorts of investments they have and that sort of thing. And in saying that, I would tell you that Montana has rejected both of those approaches. So, again, I think those are important parts of the reform. Unfortunately, they haven't been done in my own state.
And we've got another question.
The next question will be from Nathan Hopkins. Mr. Hopkins, we can't hear you. Please check your mute button.
Sorry about that. I was wondering, most of the money seems to be coming from the plaintiff's bar and business interests, but I was curious about the contents of these advertisements, especially the negative ones. Are they talking about the interests of plaintiffs and the interests of business, or are they talking about other things that might have more resonance with voters?
That's a great question, and you know, interestingly, it's typically the latter. So, you know, one of the things that is most notable is how many of these negative ads focus on criminal justice issues. And oftentimes, if you look at the money behind those ads, they are, you know, tort reform groups or other kind of business interest groups that aren't talking about the issues that they're actually concerned with, but are focusing on criminal justice issues because it's such a hot button topic, and because, you know, judges are, you know, the accusation of being soft on crime carries so much weight with the public. So in fact, one of the things that's most troubling about the negative advertisements that we see is that, you know, they're usually not engaging, they're not really about what they claim to be about. You know, they're not engaging with the issues that the interest groups are actually concerned about. They're focused on what's most likely to rile up the public, and unfortunately are in doing that often distorting and misrepresenting the records of the judges who are the subjects of those attacks.
I think that's exactly correct. That's been my experience too, that especially criminal justice issues, I know of several Supreme Court justices around the country, good people, good solid people who lost elections simply because they voted the wrong way in a homicide case or a rape case. A good judge in the Supreme Court justice in Idaho was turned out of office because she voted the wrong way on an Indian rights case in a community that, or in a state that is not overly protective of Indian rights. So it's those kinds of one-issue things that can derail a candidacy.
Well, thank you so much, everyone, for participating in today's call. I want to thank the Honorable James C. Nelson, Alicia Bannon, and Joanna Shepherd Bailey for joining us this afternoon. If you'd like to learn more about money in state courts, visit the resource pages at the ACS website. You can find it at www.acslaw.org/state-courts. You can also contact David Lyle, Senior Counsel for State Advancement, at dlyle, L-Y-L-E, at acslaw.org. Today's call has also been approved for a half hour of CLE credit in California, Illinois, Minnesota, Pennsylvania, Texas, Washington, and Wisconsin. If you're interested in CLE credit, you can contact Katie O'Connor, Assistant Director for Lawyer Chapters here at ACS. Her email address is kocnnor@acslaw.org. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Once again, this does conclude today's conference call. Thank you all for your participation. You may now disconnect.